You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
Last week, the Supreme Court of Canada handed down a decision that grants a former sex trade worker and a group run by and for street-based sex workers public interest standing in a challenge to adult prostitution laws. The legal effort began in 2007. Sex Workers United Against Violence, or SWAV, launched a constitutional challenge to those laws, but the federal government asked the court to deny them standing. The decision at the highest court came after decisions were appealed by both sides at lower courts. Pivot Legal Society has been representing the women. Pivot Legal say this is a significant victory and will set a precedent for greater access to justice for marginalized people across Canada. Eileen Sigurdsson is co-counsel in the case, and she joins me in the studio this morning. Hello, Eileen.
Good morning.
Now, what is public interest standing?
Public interest standing is something that the courts have come up with to make sure that laws aren't immunized from challenge when there are not litigants out there who can come forward and challenge their constitutionality or their legality. So it creates a way for cases to occur when otherwise it would be impossible to do so because of the circumstances of the potential plaintiffs in that case.
If we look at this case a bit more closely, then that will become even more clear. What does it mean for Sherry Kisselback and SWAV that they're going to be able to have public interest standing?
Well, what it means is that they are entitled to go to the court and make arguments before the court and bring evidence to the court to show the effects of the laws in the criminal code affecting sex work or prostitution and demonstrate that those laws have effects on people that they represent, but also on a number of other people across the country. So it allows them to demonstrate the effect of the laws on a group of people, kind of in a more global sense.
So the person who is affected doesn't have to be in court. They can be brought in as kind of, I don't know if evidence, not evidence in a legal sense, but evidence in a more general sense, evidence that there is a problem with the law.
They can be represented by Ms. Kisselback and by SWAV. So yeah, it allows voices that might otherwise be excluded because of the impossibility of their bringing a case forward, it allows them the opportunity to be heard.
What argument did the government have for denying the women public interest standing in the first place?
The government would have prioritized what we think of it as private standing. And private standing is where there's an individual who is directly affected by the law. And in this case, that might be someone is charged under one of the criminal code provisions, or they are, in this circumstance, they are currently engaged in sex work, so suffering the consequences right at this moment of the effects of the laws. So the government suggested that the public interest standing test should have been read narrowly, and that only if there was no other way for a case to come forward, such as there were no charges under the criminal code, nobody was being charged, or it was impossible for any one person to come forward and say, I'm a current sex worker. Only in those situations should a public interest standing litigation be permitted. But what happened in this case was the court said, that's a way too narrow reading.
The Supreme Court said.
That's right. Yeah, that's a too narrow reading of this law of public interest standing, and it doesn't actually allow the purposes of public interest standing to be fulfilled when it's so narrow.
Now, why did the judges decide that the group should be able to testify as a group and not in their own names, as the government wanted them to do?
Right. So the group was able to have standing to bring this litigation as a plaintiff in its own name because the members of the group and the people that group represents are in a situation where they face a number of factors that make them marginalized people. members of SWAV are living in poverty. They're active sex workers. Many of them face addictions and health issues. And those types of factors limit the ability of one person to come forward and say, I'm going to put myself in the public eye. I'm going to put my whole life on the line under examination as a witness, a person under scrutiny in the media. And not only the scrutiny, but the commitment to following a piece of litigation through for potentially 5 years or more is well-nigh impossible for many of the people who are meeting their subsistence needs through sex work, who are suffering from illnesses, who are engaged in sometimes very difficult and dangerous occupations. So what SWAV does is it stands in their place and it allows their voices to come through, but it actually is there as the plaintiff. And so It's a representative type of function, kind of in the way that you would think of as a union represents the body of workers bringing forward a concern, say, to the government.
How does this ruling giving them public interest standing have broader implications for marginalized groups in the justice system as a whole? Because I understand it is a precedent-setting decision.
It is. The way that I think it can affect other groups' opportunities to pursue litigation is that the test has opened up a little bit. And what it means is that in situations where a group can show that it's a reasonable and an effective way to challenge a law, it can do so in the way that SWAV has done. So groups that represent, say, refugees, people with disabilities, people facing other types of marginalization, say women who experience abuse, women who want to seek to protect their reproductive rights, things that are either private or that have marginalizing effects on those groups, they are able to now not be excluded from having standing as a plaintiff. So I think what it does is it recognizes that there can be both expertise and a practical function in a litigation coming forward in this way. So it really has the chance to open up the courts a little bit to people who might be excluded because of those kind of practical impossibilities that they face.
If the constitutional challenge does succeed and the prostitution laws are struck down, what could be the positive outcomes for street levels sex workers?
Well, I think there's a few ways of looking at that. One is if the body house laws are struck down, and those are the laws that prevent people from working indoors legally, that gives people the opportunity to work inside in their own spaces in circumstances that are measurably safer. So that's one way that street level sex workers could have the opportunity to increase safety. Another is if the communicating provision, which is the provision that makes it illegal to communicate in public for the purpose of prostitution, if that gets eliminated, the way in which the law are enforced against sex workers, which is to move them into basically the darkest and most dangerous parts of cities, would be eliminated and would ensure that that those kinds of movements of populations didn't happen, and that the opportunity for sex workers to be more visible, be more actively engaged in seeking police protection would be there. And so there would be ways to engage basic citizenship, essentially, participating in the public openly, participating with law enforcement openly without fear of being arrested. Those would have great advantages for safety.
What is the current state for women working street level as sex workers? I mean, what kind of level of violence and intimidation do they face?
They face, I would say, a number of levels of violence and intimidation. Because of the dangerous circumstances, they face dangerous clients. The fact that they have to work in really remote and invisible locations means that they're very vulnerable. Because of their criminalized status, they're vulnerable to law enforcement that isn't acting correctly or ethically. But they're also vulnerable to stigma, to public stigma, isolation, non-acceptance as members of our community. So criminalization really has layered effects on people, especially and most markedly on people working at the street level.
So your hope, I know you've been involved with this case for a long time, your hope would be if the prostitution laws are struck down, that some of the stigma would also start to lessen?
Yeah, I think that one of the goals, and this is a goal of people involved in sex work, is to not be excluded from society by being marked as criminals. And these are people being marked as criminals for actually doing an activity that's not illegal. Selling a sexual act for money or other consideration is actually legal. You're allowed to do that under the law. It's just these kind of other trappings of the law that regulate the way in which it's done that are illegal. So, one of the things that sex workers want is to be seen as legitimate members of our community. And I think that could help.
What's next in the case?
We have this decision that permits our clients to have standing. So now we have to work with them and determine when the best opportunity is to move forward with the trial and the litigation. As you might know, there's a case going on in Ontario, which involves three sex workers that are challenging certain provisions of the criminal code, not all of them. So it might depend on the course of that case when we decide to reactivate our trial, because depending on their success there, it might narrow the things that we still have to challenge. So the timing is very indeterminate at this point.
Not next week.
Not next week.
Thanks so much for coming in, Eileen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Eileen Sigurdsson. She's co-counsel with Katrina Pacey at Pivot Legal and represents Sherry Kisselback and Suave.